Well, welcome back for this very special episode of the New Parker Society series here on the Ridley Institute podcast. My name is Sam Forniker. I am your host. I am an associate rector here at St. Andrew's Anglican Church in Mount Pleasant and the director of seminary programs here at the Ridley Institute. I am also joined by two good friends of mine, Jake Griesel and Mark Ernji. Mark, you're newly joining us here. Would you like to, first of all, both of you, welcome back, Jake.
It's great to be back, Sam.
And Mark, you're new here, so why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thanks very much, Sam. Look, long-time listener, first-time caller. Nice to be part of the conversation. Nice to get together with some brothers from all sides of the world and talk about Reformation things and people. What a joy it is to talk about Hugh Latimer. I enjoy teaching about Latimer and encouraging students and other ministers to get excited about Latimer. So it's nice to be able to spend a bit of time with you guys talking about him as well.
Mark, actually, just to get us rolling, so as you said, we're talking on this episode about Hugh Latimer, the great English reformer. So maybe I could just we could start by getting you talking here. You're familiar, I gather, with Latimer's biography. Can you give us a little bit of a snapshot of the man's life?
Yeah, absolutely, Sam. Look, I mean, Hugh Latimer is one of those names of the English Reformation that lots of people are familiar with. One of the three Oxford martyrs: Ridley, Latimer, Cranmer, the great preacher of the English Reformation, the apostle to England, sometimes referred to. And, you know, he's an extraordinary guy. Lived under various reigns of various monarchs, 70 years of life, which is quite a long life for people in that time. Look, what can we say about Latimer? I'll just give a brief snapshot of I'll sketch out some of his sort of early days. Hugh Latimer was born around the year 1485, the end of the 15th century. He was born in a little place in Leicestershire. In fact, I discovered he was born less than an hour's walk, at least by Google Maps, to where Lady Jane's family had Bradgate Park. So I thought there may be some connection there with the Grey family, but that's a point we'll leave to the side. He grew up in a humble farming family. His dad was called Hugh, had a few sisters, farming origins. I think that's really significant to, you know, a lot of the rest of his life in ministry ought to be sort of read in that context of a bloke who's down to earth, understands farming principles, and a common man. We can come back to this later on in the conversation. Anyway, he goes up to Cambridge and studies. He comes and he's amazingly converted, by Thomas Bilney, Little Bilney in Cambridge. So it's quite an extraordinary story there, where he talks about a Master Bilney, or he calls him Saint Bilney, and so that's a beautiful little relationship they have in Cambridge, where they encourage each other. I'll move forward a little bit. Latimer becomes quite a prominent person in Cambridge. He's got some important roles at the university. He's an important preacher. He's important to the little group of reformers that meet at the White Horse Tavern on Mill Lane. So he's quite an important person. We know him best for his preaching. And so under the reigns of King Henry VIII and King Edward VI, he's one of the most prominent preachers of the English Reformation at that time. But we can leave that there for now. He's an extraordinary guy, and we'll come back to some of these things in our conversation.
Thank you so much for that. Maybe we could, as you said, kind of get right into those sermons. We're looking today principally at the sermons on the card and on the plow. Jake, can you kind of introduce us a little bit more to these sermons we're going to be talking about?
Sure, Sam. So Latimer's works, we've got two volumes of Latimer's works in the Parker Society Library. Most of the extant works are sermons. There are a few letters, but most of them are sermons. And, of course, Latimer, as Mark rightly said, was primarily known as a powerful preacher. And so in this episode, we'll be looking at two of his extant sermons, preached in different contexts. The first one preached under the reign of Henry VIII in 1529, the Sermon on the Card, which is actually also part of a series, Sermons on the Card. And the other one preached later in 1549 under the young boy King Edward VI, so-called Sermon on the Plough. So, Mark, would you provide some context for us concerning the first sermon, the Sermon on the Card under Henry VIII in 1529?
Yeah, I sure can. So this is, a mere 5 years after Latimer is converted through a little building. And this is an important sermon, very significant sermon, preached on the 19th of December that same year that you mentioned, 1529. And it's preached in St. Edward's Church in Cambridge, a little pokey one around by the second-hand bookshop, which is fantastic today. That time in Cambridge was really significant in the late 20s, about to roll into the 30s. You had Thomas Wolsey's recent fall from grace, discussions about King Henry VIII and his, wife or is it Catherine of Aragon and the annulment. These things are really trundling on. The group who meet in the White Horse Tavern, known as Germany, why? Because they're discussing Lutheran ideas. There's all sorts of little raids into the White Horse and people are scurrying out back to their rooms at Queen's College and John's trying to hide their little Lutheran contraband. And then you have, a guy like Hugh Latimer, who's the university cross-bearer, who's one of the significant preachers of the university, and he stands up and he basically puts out Lutheran ideas from the pulpit. That is to say, he's preaching about justification by faith alone, and he's really emphasising a lot of the kind of ethical and pastoral pieces bound up in Lutheran ideas. Now, this particular sermon that we have that's extant today, it's not the first in the series. What we know is that there's these sermons being preached. And previously, there was a Benedictine by the name of Dr. John Venutus. Dr. John Venutus was a deputy vice chancellor there at Cambridge. And he'd attacked Latimer, calling Latimer mad, calling Latimer brainless for his sort of ideas. And it's interesting, in this sermon, you see Latimer's directly responding to those accusations, quoting Dr. John Venutus in the text. And we know that after this, the sort of second sermon that we've got, there was a famous encounter with Robert Buckingham, who's a Dominican, head of the Dominican house in Cambridge. And this is a fantastic little story with Buckingham. In fact, I might just say a couple of things about it. So Buckingham heard all that first sermon that Latimer preached and didn't like it one bit. He countered with his own Sermons on the Dice, and they claimed that the Bible was just too complicated for common folk to obey. And so that was read rag to a bull for Latimer, who responded that the Bible was able to be, clear, was clear on matters of faith and sufficient for salvation. But anyway, Buckingham was so refuted so successfully that John Fox says that never after that he durst peep out of the pulpit again at Master Latimer. So basically Latimer put him in his place. And so this sort of set of sermons is quite significant, because it shows Latimer pushing back on a lot of the conservative ideas of the day and pushing forward with some Lutheran ideas and a prominent role at Cambridge.
And I think it's so clear from what you've just described, Mark, how Latimer's very aware of his context and his audience. He aimed his sermons at a very particular audience with particular listeners in mind. And I think that also shows in the contents of a sermon in this particular case, the Sermon on the Card. You can see that, for example, in the use of the analogies or the kind of analogies that he uses to address his audience. So, for example, in this particular sermon, early on in the sermon, on pages 4 to 7, he uses this analogy of an English captain set over the town of Calais. So Latimer likens the fall of mankind into sin to an Englishman who was of the king's mere good pleasure and favor, bestowed with many honors, privileges, and riches, on the one condition that he be the chief captain and defender of the town of Calais, which, of course, at that time was the only English possession on the French coastline and was therefore of vital political and military strategic importance. However, this English captain spurned his king's benevolence and betrayed his king by becoming friendly with his enemies, the French, and allowing the French to take over the town of Calais because of his own negligence. And even though the English king was powerful enough to reclaim the town of Calais from the French, yet the treasonous English captain who allowed the town to fall into the French hands was justly stripped of all its honors and possessions that had previously been given him by the English king. And he had to face the justice that was due to traitors. So Latimer uses this analogy to say, well, that was what the original creation was like. God provided mankind with all kinds of gifts and benefits, especially his presence and favor. And what did mankind do? They spurned it and teamed up and became friends, as it were, with the devil. Now, what's really fascinating is how, in this analogy, the French are likened to the devil. So that's so typically English, right? So that's the one analogy that shows how he really knew his audience and how to speak to them in language they could understand. But there's another one as well. For example, he uses monastic terms and monastic concepts, or at least the surrounding familiarity with monasticism to make a point. For example, this sermon is deeply concerned about the Christian's identity. If someone should ask, "Who are you?" the Christian should answer, according to Latimer, "I am a Christian man, a Christian woman, the child of everlasting joy, the merits of the bitter passion of Christ." And then Latimer strikingly adds, "This is a joyful answer," to be able to say, "I am a Christian, I belong to Christ." But he then asks, "What doth Christ require of a Christian man or a Christian woman?" And then he uses an analogy taken from the monastic world with which his audience would have been familiar. He says, "Christ requires nothing else of a Christian man or woman, but that they will observe his rule. For likewise, as he is a good Augustan friar that keepeth well St. Augustine's rule, so is he a good Christian man that keepeth well Christ's rule." That's on page 8. And Mark referred earlier to how there were different monastic houses at Cambridge at the time, a Benedictine house, an Augustinian house, a Franciscan house, and so on. So his audience would have been well familiar with this. And this is where the sermon's title comes in. Sermons on the Card, it's called. Sam, would you like to explain that?
Yeah, it's a crucial analogy, right? The cards analogy, hence Sermon on the Cards. And specifically, Latimer, he frames the sermon using this analogy of triumph or trumps. It's a game. Actually, interestingly, I seem to recall somewhere reading that it was a game that originated in France. If someone is listening who's a historian of cards, they're welcome to write in with angry listener mail and correct me. But I think possibly originated in France. It's a lot like the older game Whist. So it's a trick-taking game, you know, like we might play spades today or something like that. So the game in which you can throw down the trump card and you know, take the whole hand. So he's very much deploying that analogy throughout the sermon, which is where his emphasis on the heart comes in. Often Latimer will talk about throwing down your heart, you know, as the trump. So maybe we'll come back to that. I think it's worth saying Latimer's metaphors here and elsewhere, they're really vivid. They're calculatedly accessible. And in that sense, we might say today, contextualized. I think also worth pointing out, though, they're specifically suited to their time. So we read in the next century, the church historian Thomas Fuller, he would reflect in one of his great works, how by the next century, preaching that was so blunt as Latimer's, it could be, he says in his words, fondly imitated, and yet it could produce nothing but laughter. Because it was clear that people were, it would be like today if someone, you know, tried to preach exactly like Spurgeon preached. You couldn't help but just chuckle at it because it would seem so put on. right, but in Latimer's day, his preaching was, again, just to use Fuller's language, in those dark days, admirably effectual. Actually, that's not Fuller's language. That's a guy called Singer in one of these histories on the playing card. So anyway, it's just a good reminder that plain or straight shooting preaching of the kind that Latimer's such a wonderful illustration, it needs to be calibrated to the people in the pew, which was Latimer's great lesson, not to this idea of what Latimer sort of looked like or what Latimer sound like any more than we would want to sort of, you know, imitate somebody like Spurgeon or, you know, or even a later preacher sound precisely like John Stott in our preaching today. Not sounding like Latimer, but emulating his faithfulness to the task of preaching. That makes sense. Mm.
Mm, but, yes. Yeah, when you made that comment, came to my mind as J.C. Ryle. Remember reading Andrew Atherston's biography of, or version of the autobiography on J.C. Ryle. He's this incredibly able guy who takes a parish where he has to learn how to sort of get alongside the common man and woman and communicate to their hearts. And that principle of being able to get down and see eye to eye and communicate, it's just that's going to look different for every generation in different places and different cultures. But man, that's an important principle. And I love seeing that in Latimer.
Mm. Yeah, Mark spoke earlier about how Latimer had engaged in evangelical Lutheran ideas in Cambridge and how he became persuaded by that and started propagating Protestant evangelical doctrines. And yet I find it interesting in this particular sermon that we're looking at to note that notwithstanding these evangelical inclinations in Latimer, his thinking, at least at this point in time, was still very much shaped by late medieval piety and moral categories, you might say. For example, on page 23 of the text, he makes a distinction between so-called voluntary and necessary works. Now, necessary works include works done in obedience to Christ's express commandments. You might say the Ten Commandments and the Sermon on the Mount and other such teachings, including showing mercy to the poor and the afflicted through alms or other forms of charity, and offering regular tithes. These are necessary works, whereas so-called voluntary works include works that go beyond or in addition to these necessary works, such as giving offerings to the church beyond the regular tithes, including contributions to church buildings and furnishing, or the gilding of saints, which was the coating of images and icons with gold leaves, or things like going on holy pilgrimages or offering of votive candles in the churches and so on. These are all voluntary works that go beyond really what's required in the category of necessary works. And although Latimer strongly insisted in the sermon that necessary works were what much more to be emphasized and preferred to so-called voluntary works, yet he does not reject, at least in the sermon, he doesn't reject voluntary works as a category altogether. And on the one hand, this might simply reflect the late medieval background and suggest that Latimer's evangelical inclinations were still in development. We must remember this is still under Henry VIII. But on the other hand, it could also have been the case that under Henry VIII, Latimer was playing it safe by shying away from openly rejecting the notion of voluntary works, while instead tactically directing his audience to the much greater importance of so-called necessary works. In other words, being obedient to the rule of Christ rather than these additional voluntary works.
Yeah, I hope we can dig in maybe just a little bit more into that distinction later on. I think just here it's worth pointing out that Latimer's preaching, it reiterates that same message that we heard in the homilies. The gospel produces fruit, right? And I've always been struck by the fact that Anglicans down the centuries, who we would not consider especially friendly to the Reformation, so I'm thinking of people here like Evelyn Underhill, they find the distinctive character of the Anglican tradition in its ethos of practical godliness, which there's this great section in Underhill's book Worship, in her study of the prayer book communion liturgy, where she points this out. She says it's not kind of high Baroque Eucharistic mysticism, right? It's there's this emphasis on practical godliness, and I think there's something therefore so widely appealing. There's real gold in Latimer here, and there's a reason that people, Anglicans of all kinds, find it really difficult not to get into Latimer when they read this sermon. So Latimer's both sermons on the card, especially the second sermon's, a great example of this. I think it's in the second sermon where we hear Latimer wax lyrical about the trump card, which I mentioned before, not insignificantly termed the heart. Again, this point of the gospel producing fruitfulness, taking hold of the heart, and out of the heart flowing this kind of lively, necessary obedience to Christ.
Well, I think this is a really significant point you raise, Sam. In my reading of the extant sermons that we have of Latimer's, I was really struck by the way he so often, when he discusses faith, makes a point of discussing its relationship to good works that flow on from a lively faith. It's really frequent. I think part of that is there was a common accusation against evangelicals and gospelers of the day that, you know, faith alone, faith alone, faith alone, and you can do whatever you want, antinomianism. But you don't see any of that in Latimer. If anything, he's at pains to demonstrate that's not the case. A great example, and I'll read you this. This is from a later sermon of his. He's talking about faith, and that and the good works are never absent from true faith. He says, "This faith is a great state, a lady, a duchess, a great woman, and she hath ever a great company and train about her, as a noble estate ought to have. First, she hath a gentleman usher that goeth before her, and where he is not, there is not lady faith. And this gentleman usher is called Agnitio Peccatorum, the knowledge of sin. When we enter into our heart and acknowledge our faults and stand about not to defend them. And he's none of these wingers. He kicks not when he hears his fault. Now, as the gentleman usher goeth before us, so she hath a train to come after her. And yet, though they come behind, they be all of faith's company. So all these wait upon faith. She has a great train after her. Beside her, a gentleman usher, her whole household, and those be the works of our vocation, and every man considereth what vocation is in, what calling, and doth the work to the same." Mm. So it's a package deal for Latimer, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing we see in him frequently.
Man, I'm so glad you read that, Mark. I had no idea you were going to bring that out, but I love, C.S. Lewis wrote a little book on Edmund Spencer. And he talks about how, sorry, this is a wildly arcane lay-by here, but he talks in that little book about this, the whole idea of the masquerade in Spencer's poetic work. So Spencer's writing, in the Elizabethan period, so a little bit after this, but drawing on this medieval kind of masquerade tradition. So when you think about the parade of all the vices after Lady Pride. And this kind of thing appears throughout Spencer's great work, The Faery Queen. It's another example in that passage of where Latimer is reaching into the cultural imagination of his day, drawing on a kind of practice or a pattern or something that his listeners would just intuitively grasp, and then using it to great effect in the pulpit. That's really, I've never heard that passage before. It's really cool. And I think there's a really helpful modern present-day takeaway here. If we could just if I could touch on that quickly. So one thing I've come to appreciate is you will find English Roman Catholic writers. So I think of people here like G.K. Chesterton or Hilaire Belloc. You'll also find modern day writers. So the recent convert to Romanian Orthodoxy, Paul Kingsnorth. And these folks will argue that Western culture, the moment when it really tanked, when things started to go wrong, it was thanks to the naivete of Protestant-led industrialism when Parliament passed the Enclosure Act. So kind of in industrial age Britain, when Parliament passed the Enclosure Act. And there is, the more that I've been reading Latimer, the more that I've been kind of digging into the works of Cranmer, the more that I've found that actually these reformers were consciously responding to the practice of enclosure before it was, you know, put on the books politically, as it were. So maybe later English Protestantism did, in this sinful way, engage with, encourage iniquitous, also just dumb economic practices. But in doing so, these later folks, so kind of 17th, 18th century folks, they put clear blue water between themselves and the reformers, like Latimer and Ridley. So the takeaway for me, the encouragement for me, is that, gosh, evangelical reformational Anglicans actually should be the first to insist that the flow of what a Christian stewards should be from private property to common objects of love and communion, not vice versa. And the reason I'm highlighting all of this is it seems to me that there is a big need for evangelical input in what we might call Anglican social teaching. And Latimer just indicates that there's a lot of scope for future work on the Tudor reformers' social vision. So I guess I'm curious, Mark, do you know anything about the enclosure issue in particular? Is that something that Latimer is concerned about?
Yeah, absolutely, Sam. Like you said before, this is a massive issue, particularly around this, this time of the Reformation, and especially under Edward VI, we see more of it in the mid to late 1540s and early 1550s. The enclosure issue is massive. It's massively important. Land's been shared and farmed for many, many years, and people would graze on nobles' lands, and it was understood that that was the case. But when land started to get enclosed and people started to get booted off land, it caused a whole lot of hardship and starvation. Now, Latimer really feels this deeply. Remember, he's a farmer. He's grown up in a farming family. He gets that. He understands the needs, the sustenance, and the kind of things that would happen if people are unjustly booted out of land. So he often lambasts the greed of the nobles. Frequently he does this. He has a real crack at them, and especially about the matter of the enclosures. In fact, he pushed his luck having a crack at them in his final court sermon of 1550, and evidently offended the nobles such that he wasn't invited back. The straw that broke the camel's back or something. But part of the issue was this: the massive wealth redistribution that was taking place, it really did take place with the dissolution of the monasteries and the break from Rome and the need to defend the realm after that and then procure all the power brokers of the country in order to do that. So there was an enormous wealth redistribution that went on, and you'll find in the writings of Cranmer, Latimer, John Ponnet, Nicholas Ridley, plenty of others, they were so conscious of this issue, especially when the enclosures were one such pressure point. So Latimer was quite sympathetic with some of the rebellions that went on. He had to be very careful with how he worded things. But this is, of course, why these commonwealth men, the commonweal, the commonwealth, the shared wealth of the kingdom, they put a premium on education and virtuous citizenry. The idea was that you would actually be able to see truly virtuous citizens sharing, truly virtuous citizens, knowing what's private property, but loving one's neighbour. And that's exactly what you see in this sermon. You see Latimer talk about deeds of charity. You see Latimer talk about loving your neighbour. Mm. How? Loving with mind, heart, eyes, tongue, feet, hands and body. So this is part of the Commonwealth package. If you want to do future research, think about how early modern virtue theory connects with the Commonwealth political theology.
So up to this point, we've been looking at this sermon on the card, which was in 1529. But for the second sermon, we have to fast forward by 20 years into a different political landscape. We're looking now at the Sermon on the Plough, which was preached in 1549 at St. Paul's Cross. For those listeners who might not be familiar, St. Paul's Cross was an outdoor pulpit just outside St. Paul's Cathedral in London. Very effective way of communicating the gospel throughout the week, especially under Edward VI, to preach to the public. And this particular sermon on the plough is said to have been preached in the shrouds. The shrouds were like a sheltered space at the side of St. Paul's Cathedral, where these St. Paul's Cross sermons could take place whenever there was rainy or inclement weather. And so this particular sermon happened to be undercover. Yes, Mark, what can you tell us about this sermon?
Well, just to throw in a couple of things, it was the fourth and the last of a little sermon series. And the series we might call today the Sermons Plural on the Plough. And the first three were about the seed, and this last one's about the plower of the seed. Latimer had preached some sermons the year before and really was being, in some ways, wheeled out as the great preacher of this new Edwardian regime, making massive religious changes. So he was a figurehead to see things like, the homilies encouraged, injunctions followed. The Book of Common Prayer was about to come out that year. And at the head of all of that, the public face on so much of it was Hugh Latimer.
As Mark was alluding to there, that these sermon series on the plough, they take their name from the biblical image of the ministers of God's word as ploughmen or sowers, if you will, who plough God's field and then sow the seed of the word. And Latimer explains, as Mark also mentioned there, that in the first three sermons of this series, he had spoken of what seed, in other words, what doctrine, is to be sown into God's field. Whereas in this fourth and presumably final sermon, the attention turns to the plowers or the sowers themselves, in other words, the preachers, the clergy. And Latimer then describes the office of a preacher, and he says that the first task of the preacher is, quote, to bring his flock, in other words, Christ's flock, to a right faith, as Paul calleth it, and not a swerving faith, but to a faith that embraceth Christ and trusteth in his merits. A lively faith, a justifying faith, a faith that maketh a man righteous without respect of works, as ye have it very well declared and set forth in the homily. End quote. Now, I'd like to observe here two things about that quote. The first thing is that Latimer says that true faith, that is the kind of faith that justifies a person before God, includes not merely a knowledge of the gospel and an intellectual assent to its message as being true, but it also includes a self-abnegation, if you will, a total rejection of any merits in ourselves in order to embrace Christ and his merits or his righteousness alone for our justification before God. That's the kind of faith he has in mind here. You can see the Lutheran / broader Protestant, even Reformed impulse coming through. And then it's very interesting that Latimer here in this very quote, he says, as you have it well or very well declared and set forth in the homily. Now he's preaching this to a St. Paul's Cross audience. In other words, he's directing the audience to the 1547 Book of Homilies, in such a way that suggests that they would have been familiar with these official sermons of this newly reformed English church, even though these homilies were only published a year and a half earlier. Because the homilies, the Book of Homilies, at least the first Book of Homilies, to exclude the Elizabethan one, was published on the 31st July of 1547. And so at least this suggests that the impact of the homilies, only 18 months after they were published, they would have got such a reception that it's warranted for Latimer to appeal to them as if the audience should know what he's speaking about, including their contents, the homily on salvation. However, the definition of faith that Latimer gave a little bit earlier suggests it's all about claiming Christ in his righteousness for our salvation and bringing lost souls into the kingdom. But he's clear, however, that preaching is not only about converting the lost, but also edifying the converted. Mm. It's more than just bringing souls into the kingdom, it's building them up in the kingdom. And then, very notably, Latimer says that the preaching of the word is a weighty matter. The preaching of the word is meat that is meant for regular nourishment. He's calling for regular, weekly, if not daily, preaching here. He says it's not strawberries or dainties that are only for occasional consumption. And he complains of his fellow clergy who seldom preach. And he says, quote, many of the clergy make a strawberry of it, of preaching, ministering it but once a year. But such do not the office of good prelates. He says that on page 62. And it's also noteworthy here that Latimer uses the word prelate to refer to all the clergy, not just to bishops.
I love that phrase, strawberry preachers. And apparently there's a note in the text which says that it caught on to describe non-resident clergy in Latimer's day. So, you know, you would have absenteeism, which would not be reformed for a long time, clergy not really properly living in their areas, ministering among their people. So this phrase, strawberry preacher, came to be used to describe those folks. And just parenthetically here, thank God for gospel preaching bishops, right? I mean, I know because I work for one of them. but I think what a thing we have to be thankful for in the circuits that the three of us run in, that we have gospel preaching bishops. There's a wonderful exhortation that Latimer gives in this sermon. He says, "Ye that be prelates, look well to your office, for right prelating is busy laboring and not lording. Therefore preach and teach, and let your plow be doing. Ye lords, I say, that live like loiterers, look well to your office. The plow is your office and charge. If you live idle and loiter, you do not your duty, you follow not your vocation. Let your plow therefore be going and not cease, that the ground may bring forth fruit." One of many mic drop moments in this amazing sermon.
There are so many mic drop moments, aren't there? I mean, it really, imagine being there, you know, to hear this preached live. Wouldn't that be extraordinary? Huh? The preaching prelates, they're a contrast in this sermon, strong, colourful contrast. And the unpreaching prelates are often kind of linked with the work of the devil. You know, the role of the devil looms large in this sermon. I mean, he really has a lot to say about Satan and the work that kind of works against the growth of the kingdom and the work of the faithful ploughman. You know, the way he speaks about that Italian bishop yonder, his chaplain, i.e., you know, the devil's chaplain. Many things could be said. he says, Satan sows darn and cockle versus the corn, which is sown by the good preaching prelates. Another contrast. And what he's saying is that the preaching and the teaching of the truth is a deeply spiritual act. And, I think one that modern preachers would do well to be really cognizant of, that this is a deeply spiritual act and involved in a kind of battle that you can't just perceive with your physical eyes. There is a real battle going on. So Latimer's clued into all this, and he really is conscious that the enemy is working against, you know, the kingdom's advance. And he's got that lovely, you know, one of the many phrases he uses that he has to sort of make his point with. And I love this one, and I love the way that I'll read it out. It says, "There is one that passes all the other, and is the most diligent prelate and preacher in all England." Imagine hearing this, and Latimer says, "And will you know who it is?" Thinking, "Yes, I'd like to know." He continues, "I will tell you, it is the devil. He's the most diligent preacher of all of others. He's never out of his diocese. He's never from his cure. You shall never find him unoccupied. He's ever in his parish. He keepeth residence at all times. You shall never find him out of the way. Call for him when you will. He's ever at home. The diligentest preacher in all the realm. He is ever at his plough." You know, isn't that a kind of a homiletical stroke of genius?
Yeah.
that kind of makes his point so well. Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that section.
Just keeping an eye on the time, turn our corner towards the end, and I wonder, just in the spirit of kind of practical takeaways, if we take together Latimer's sermons on the card and on the plow, you know, where does this leave us? And I'd like to suggest for listeners just three brief takeaways to consider on the other side of this. And the first is this. Latimer would say to us, get catechized, get trained in the faith. So as a bishop, Latimer called his clergy to a deeper knowledge of the scriptures. We read in his visitation articles and injunctions as he goes around his diocese, you know, visiting these parishes. He says, every one of you, speaking to the clergy, every one of you must have of your own a whole Bible, if you can conveniently, or at the least a New Testament, both in Latin and English, before the Feast of the Nativity of our Lord next ensuing. So obviously a time stamp on that. The starting point for a fruitful life of discipleship, says Latimer, is the Bible, understood, shared, and bringing nourishment among fellow believers. Latimer, in fact, encouraged Christians to read, so not just clergy, right? He encouraged folks in the pew to read and study closely at least a chapter a day, and to say, quote, "not only in preaching and open communication, but also in secret, the Our Father, the Creed, and the Ten Commandments." And I think actually that was directed specifically to ministers, but certainly in spirit to the wider church. Point being, training oneself in these pillars of classic Christian faith formation, catechesis, is still absolutely key to the Christian life. Latimer reminds us of that. So that's the first. Here's the second. Build up fellow believers in solid doctrine. We've already spoken about the edifying work of the word preached. Well, listen to Latimer again. He says, "No parson, vicar, curate, nor chantry priest from henceforth do discourage any layperson from the reading of any good books, either in Latin or English, but rather animate and encourage them unto such things." And you can hear Latimer kind of cutting away what we might today refer to as kind of a clericalism or sacerdotalism, right? Studying sound doctrine is not the preserve of the clergy. A robust Christian life is so much more than understanding Christian doctrine alone, and yet that understanding is basic and foundational. So build one another up in solid doctrine. And then third and finally, again, we've touched on this throughout, bear gospel fruit. So again, just a quote from, I believe this is another sermon of Latimer's. I don't recall seeing this. I think I found this at another point in Latimer's work. "Whosoever now is endued with love and charity, we may call Christ's servant. For love is the token whereby you shall know such a servant that pertaineth to Christ, so that charity, charitas, agape, right, may be called the very livery of Christ. He that hath charity is Christ's servant. He that hath not charity is the servant of the devil. For like as Christ's livery is love and charity. So the devil's livery is hatred, malice, and discord. So Mark, just going right back to that that amazing excerpt that you gave us earlier with all that kind of masquerade imagery. Third and finally, bear gospel fruit. So I wonder, Mark, could you just draw us to a close by kind of returning us to Latimer's life and biography and really drawing us to a conclusion?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, Latimer practiced what he preached. Not perfectly, like any of us, but he did. Yeah. At the end of his life, as we know, King Edward VI died. Queen Mary, aka Bloody Mary, came to the throne. Latimer was arrested and thrown in the Tower of London with Ridley and Latimer, actually, and then shifted up to Oxford with Picardo. Over a succession of meetings, he was interrogated over his beliefs. He was commanded to recant, to reunite with the Church of Rome, but he stood fast. And for that, he was burned. That incredible essay that J.C. Ryle wrote, Why Were Our Reformers Burned, gives the account of what took place that day. Ryle says the following. On that day of their martyrdom, that is Ridley, Latimer and Cranmer, they were brought separately to the place of execution, which was the end of Broad Street, Oxford, close to Balliol College. Ridley arrived on the ground first and, seeing Latimer come afterwards, ran to him and kissed him, saying, Be of good heart, brother, for God will either assuage the fury of the flames or else strengthen us who abide it. Then they prayed earnestly and talked with one another, though no one could hear what they said. After this, they had to listen to a sermon by a wretched renegade divine named Smith, and being forbidden to make any answer, were commanded to make ready for death. Ridley's last words before the fire was lighted with these. Heavenly Father, I give you most hearty thanks that you have called me to a profession of you even unto death. I beseech you, Lord God, have mercy on this realm of England and deliver the same from all her enemies. Latimer's last words were like the blast of a trumpet, which rings even to this day. Be of good comfort, Master Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day, by God's grace, light such a candle in England as I trust shall never be put out.
Gents, I think on that note, with those immortal words of the great reformer, there on your lips, Mark, we should draw to a close. Mark, Jake, dear brothers, good to be with you both. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Jens.
Thanks, man.
Well, Alice, we miss you. Alice has been navigating a move, so she will be back in due course, as will I, with more details about the next New Parker Society installment. So be on the lookout for those. Hope you will join us again for that conversation. Meanwhile, in the weeks ahead here on the Ridley Institute podcast, I'll be chatting with Teresa Morgan of Yale Divinity School about trust in the New Testament, with Michael Lamb of Wake Forest University on Augustine of Hippo's amazingly hopeful political vision, and with a good friend, Andrew Fellows, on smuggling Jesus back into the church. Until then, my name is Sam Forniker. Thanks for joining us.